Hey y'all, welcome to the Lone Sound Magazine podcast, Music, Culture, Texas. Find us online at lonesoundmagazine.com. And here's your host, editor Jamie Siegel.
Hey everyone, my name is Jamie Siegel. I'm a journalist based in Dallas, Texas, and I'm the editor and founder of Lone Sound Magazine. Each week, we're sharing interviews with individuals who are moving our creative culture forward. From visual artists and musicians to fashion designers and producers, we're always inspired by their stories, and we hope y'all will be too. This week, I am talking to Joshua Ray Walker. He is a country artist who is really putting the storytelling back into Texas country music. He just released his second album called Glad You Made It, and it's already received praise from a ton of media outlets, among them Rolling Stone. I recently got to see him play a drive-in show in the Texas Hill Country, not too far from where my parents live, so I got to ask him about what it was like performing again after such a long hiatus. In our conversation, we talked about his tour through Scandinavia, and I was so curious to find out why he had such a large fan base there. He also tells me about what he has been up to during quarantine, from working on his third album, for which he already has a title, super exciting, to launching a size-inclusive clothing line called High, Wide, and Handsome. I was so grateful to talk to Joshua Ray Walker, and I hope that y'all enjoy our conversation.
What do all of the biggest names in music have in common? They all got their start performing for you, live in independent venues. When COVID-19 hit, the doors to all independent venues across the country closed and attending live concerts stopped. The independent venues and promoters from every state in the U.S. are banding together to fight for survival. We were the first to close and will be the last to open. While we all look forward to the day where we can walk through those doors once again, the fact is, many of us, your neighborhood venues, are at risk of closing our doors forever unless federal assistance is provided. Details on the needed support are available at SaveOurStages.com. Together, we can keep the local music scene alive. Brought to you by NEVA, the National Independent Venue Association, a 501c6.
When I saw you, this was your first show since February. What was it like playing up on stage again to real people for you?
It was good. It didn't feel like it had been as long as it had been. I was still playing to people in cars, so it's not totally the same. But it was good to just be out playing outside of my house. It was a really nice night, so
it was
sitting outside playing songs with the breeze, and you could see the stars there. I mean, it was really cool. It felt good. It's not quite normal, but it's definitely better than nothing.
A step up from what it was before. We had talked about it a little bit, that you said you hadn't gone this long without playing music in like at least a decade, probably more. So you've been playing music kind of just at shows or kind of since then for the last, what, 10, 15 years?
I've been playing live since I was 12. Well, really even before that. I hopped up on stage a few times when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
My mom was in radio and motorsports PR. So there were a couple events. One was at Texas Motor Speedway when I was like 7 or 8, and I got up and played guitar. I don't even remember who the band was, but they were big enough that they were playing the infield at a giant NASCAR race. So
right.
It was someone notable. And then I started playing in bands pretty regularly around 13, and was playing out. I would play out in Deep Ellum, and I've been doing it ever since. And then I took a little break when I was like 21.
Yeah.
And since then, it's just been full steam for almost 10 years.
Yeah. Well, it's super exciting. Also, shout out to Deep Ellum. I love that in the Rolling Stone article that came out recently that you were rocking your double wide hat. So I was like, yes, I live right next door to double wide. So,
I've probably played there 100 times in different bands and stuff.
You would also mention that, you know, Canyon, your big hit song from last year, is kind of that song that allowed you to play in Europe. My friends and I have talked about this a lot as far as coronavirus and all of that, I'm not sure, but it does seem that, you know, European people love Texas music. And, you know, it goes from Leon Bridges to, like, you know, bluegrass and Texas country. I know Paul Coffin has said something similar that, you know, they just love, I'm not sure what it is. What do you think that it is that they, you know, love our music so much?
So there are some countries in Europe that really follow the pop culture of the U.S. and then there are others that don't care for it as much. Mm-hmm. In my experience, my last tour was all in Scandinavia.
Okay.
And in Scandinavia, they really pay attention to pop culture in the U.S. and they see the distinct cultural differences, like within the United States.
Right.
So they recognize the South, the Northeast, the West Coast, Texas. Like they understand the differences between culture, and something about Texas culture. I think probably, you know, they think of the Wild West and the outlaw spirit and all that. They just relate to, and especially, you know, there are some rural parts of Sweden and Norway that I went to, and I mean, the people just have a lot of in common with the people who write and play blues and country here. They drive tractors and they live, you know, on a farm and they tend cattle. And so there's just a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very similar. And so I think it's part of that. And then there's also like, I was trying to figure out how Texas music became so ingrained in their pop culture, because like it's not like a niche thing. Like they kind of, the public at large there knows about Texas music. And like I was sitting in a fast food restaurant in Sweden. It's basically their McDonald's. It's called Max Burger. And a Alabama song came on and I was like, okay, I mean, I guess that makes sense. Right. And then a Glenn Campbell song came on and I was like, all right, you don't hear Glenn Campbell.
Cuts, yeah.
Yeah. You don't hear Glenn Campbell in a McDonald's in the US anywhere.
Yay.
And then a Tom T. Hall song came on. I'm like, okay, you just don't hear Tom T. Hall come on to a corporate radio station anywhere.
Yeah.
Even in Texas, you know?
Yeah.
And so I started poking around while I was there. And I guess what happened was in the 60s, a lot of Swedish pop artists were covering Texas country songs, but in like a Swedish kind of pop, like produced way. And so people grew up with those songs, not knowing who the original artist was. And you know, they grew up and they're like, who was that? What was that? And I guess they found the original artists and it just kind of piqued people's interests and they continued listening. I mean, I was quizzed on Townes Van Zandt and Guy Clark Records.
Really?
And Blaze Foley Records over there. And the people in Sweden and Norway knew way more about it than I did. They do. So on Townes' second record, you know, this track, this guy was playing guitar. And I was like, I don't know. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they really know their stuff. And it's multi-generational. It's not like a new thing. I thought maybe it was like a, like the hip thing.
Like a trend, like Old Town Road got really hot, you know, that
right.
Kind of thing. Yeah.
But no, it's like, it's something that's been in their culture for a couple generations now.
Wow. What was your favorite part of being in Europe, or was that your first time?
Yeah, my first flight ever. I hadn't even been on a domestic flight.
Wow.
My first flight ever was from Dallas to London, and then I caught a plane from London to Stockholm to start the tour.
Wow. Oh, my
God.
So
my first flight was like almost 11 hours.
Right. Yeah. All the way to London. Yeah.
And I landed in Heathrow, which is notably one of the largest and worst airports in Europe or the world.
Right.
And so I really jumped in the deep end. Like my first flight was 11 hours and then I landed in Heathrow and had an hour and a half to get, you know, to my other flight. And so I feel like I kind of experienced all the flight stuff. I'm a pro now after one trip to Europe.
Now I know what to expect.
But yeah, that was my first time to Europe. I didn't know exactly what to expect. I knew, I didn't know that much about Scandinavia. Besides, I mean, I flew into Sweden and I knew what most people know, ABBA, IKEA, right. You know, they pickle fish. I knew that. And they have cool furniture. So it was awesome. And I got to see so much of it. I was there for 37 days and I think I played 35 shows in 37 days.
Oh my
God. So we're just traveling constantly. I saw, and it was all by car or train. So I saw so much of the countryside. We crisscrossed all over Norway. It was really incredible. The most beautiful scenery I've ever seen. You know, I had a few days off in Copenhagen, which was beautiful. And I love Bergen, Norway, the west coast of Norway. It was just amazing. And I played a show in the Arctic Circle in Tromsø, Norway.
Whoa. What was that?
So it was incredible. That was my first domestic flight ever. It was in Norway from Trondheim to Tromsø. Oh, and my guitar was my carry-on. So I had to pack, like, you know, socks and a toothbrush in my guitar bag and
went
to the Arctic Circle. Yeah. And, like, that's all I had. And it was really a surreal experience to get out in this tiny airport.
Yeah.
After being at Heathrow, we get it at this airport that's like one gate.
Yeah.
And the plane makes multiple stops, like you're on a bus. Like it took off and landed three times.
Huh. I've never heard of that before. I mean, I've taken a lot of domestic flights, but that's crazy.
Yeah, it's because it goes to these really remote areas in northern Norway, where that's the only way in and out. So it's like a commuter plane. And like just go up this little row of towns that goes up, you know, really far. Tromsø's the last stop north. It's the farthest northern town in Norway. Or there's one called Hammer something that's smaller, but no one really goes there. And it was crazy. It was in the Arctic Circle. I played a basement bar that could have been anywhere in the world. I mean, it felt like playing a basement bar in New York or in Seattle or something. And it was packed. And, I mean, tons of people went. I was super surprised that anyone knew who I was there.
Yeah, right. I'm like, that's so awesome that you're like, you have fans like so far around the world in like the most remote of places.
Yeah, it's crazy. I saw the Aurora Borealis.
Oh, wow, the Northern Light.
Yeah. It was really faint. It was early in the year to see them, but there was this faint kind of dark green Northern Lights in the sky. And Tromsø is tucked in a fjord between two kind of cliffs, and you're on this little island thing. And it was really beautiful place and just, I never thought I'd be playing country music in a fjord, you know, in the Arctic Circle.
Yeah, no, that sounds, especially all the way from Texas, you know, where, yeah, it's just like complete opposite. Do you have plans to travel abroad to play shows later this year?
I had a show, I had a tour in Europe that I was going to be leaving for on like Wednesday, but we had to push it to 2021.
Okay.
And I still have some shows on the books in December for the UK, but I'm probably going to have to move those to 2021 as well.
Yeah. I was like, what if they don't, I'm like, are they going to let you guys in on like a visa or something since, you know, we can't travel there? Is that how that works?
I guess the idea is if travel lightens up, I would go and then there's a chance I would be quarantined for 2 weeks to get back home.
Oh.
So that's why I'm considering moving it. I don't really want to be quarantined near an airport for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So that'll probably be 2021. But yeah, I'm going to Finland, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Switzerland, Luxembourg, Germany, Spain, France.
Oh my gosh. So all Europe. Wow.
Yeah. Awesome. And then I'm trying to add on some Australian dates for 2021.
That would be so cool.
And I'll be going to Scandinavia at least twice. So I have quite a bit of touring outside of the country planned for 2021.
Yeah. So, you know, when you got into music, is that one thing that you always really wanted to do was travel, or is that just kind of like a bonus?
I have definitely always wanted to travel. That's always been a goal of mine. I didn't necessarily think that music would allow me to do it. It's a huge bonus that I get to travel outside of the U.S. to play music.
Yeah.
I always wanted to travel. So it wasn't like a goal to tour Europe, because it seemed pretty unobtainable.
Yeah.
But now that it's happening, I mean, it makes sense. I wanted to play music and I want to travel. So the fact that it's working out that I get to do both is pretty awesome.
Yeah. The second album, you just did a drive-through Good Records release party, which I thought was really cool. You know, having people drive through and giving them vinyls and all of that.
Right.
What was really special about making this album for you, from the production to, you know, the sentimentality of the songs that you've written? What makes this album like really near and dear to your heart?
I think just that I got to make another record.
Yeah.
There's no guarantee in music, and I had no idea if people were going to like the first record. I learned some things on the first record, and applied it to the second record. Like, I went out and toured the first record a lot, and I realized I could use some more upbeat material in my set. So I tried on the second record to lighten the arrangements a little bit, pep up the songs, and so the lyrics are still a lot of the same subject matter. They're pretty dark, but the arrangements are a little more fun, and it makes it easier to listen to the record all the way. And it also gives me some material to liven up my show when I play live. And then the sentiment of the record, I guess, you know, just continuing to put personal songs on the record. I guess Canyon was the personal song on the first record, and Voices is probably the, you know, the personal song on the second record. I just want to be as sincere as possible when I make these records, and everything started to kind of roll in the right direction when I was always being myself, but I realized I could just be as much of myself as I wanted. You know, like, I could really just put it all out there and be as vulnerable as I wanted to be. And it just, people seemed to like it more, where I was scared to do it at first. And when I started doing that, everything started to click. And so I guess I'm mindful to continue to do that. And so I tried to do that with the second record.
Do you ever get just kind of nervous or anxiety ridden, or just, is that something that you've kind of just worked on, getting over that hump of just being like confident, and if people don't like it, that's cool, but this is me? Or do you still wrestle with anxiety about that?
Luckily, I can't tell you where the, you know, what the cause of this is, but I've never really worried what people think about me very much, which is a huge blessing. The older I get, the more I realize how much worrying what other people think kind of drives people's decisions and stuff. And I'm sure it's hindered me in some ways in the past, but I think, you know, luckily I've always kind of felt comfortable doing what I want to do and being who I want to be. So I haven't had much anxiety about that, but just confidence is what I lacked in myself. Just like thinking that what I make or what I have to say is something that anyone actually wants to hear, you know?
Yeah.
And it took me years and years to acknowledge that I could actually sing. Like, I still hated my voice up till about 3 years ago.
That was one of my questions too. Like, have you always had such a beautiful voice? Like,
I didn't even think that I had a decent voice until, I don't know, maybe 2017 or something. And so that, you know, it took a long time. And my stage fright, I still have horrible stage fright, but it used to be like debilitating. Like, if I had to, I could always play guitar in front of people. That didn't make me that nervous. But having to sing, or especially just talk, like in between songs, I still get so nervous talking on stage. But singing, like, I would get so nervous, my hands would start shaking and I couldn't play. Or I just totally wouldn't be able to sing. My throat would close up. My stage fright was terrible. And so when I first started playing out back in like 2012, I guess, was when I started trying to sing. And I would go to like 3 or 4 open mics a week. And I just tried to play in front of people as much as I could so I could get used to that. And I would stop freezing up. And eventually I stopped freezing up. But yeah, I still, every once in a while, I'll get a wave of panic during a show. And I feel like I can hear it. I'm getting better at hiding it. But
yeah,
it always takes me a few songs to fully like settle in to the show and relax and start playing the way that I want to play, you know, like it always takes 2 or 3 songs for me to get comfortable.
Okay. That makes sense. The album, you recorded it partially here with John Pettigo. And then also in Nashville at an Airbnb there. Why did you decide to do some of that part in Nashville and do a makeshift studio setup there?
We recorded the rhythm tracks at Audio Dallas, and that's the same place we recorded the first record. So we had like scratch vocals and acoustic drums, bass, some electric guitar. So the structure of the song was already there. And we, you know, we were talking about what lead players I wanted on the record. And in the year and a half of Wish You Were Here being out, I met a lot of great players and played live with them, and about half of them happened to live in Nashville. So Pettigo and I were taking a trip to Nashville anyway to do a writing session. I've been going out to Nashville about every 6 weeks for a couple of years now, going out there to write for other people. And so we had been making that trip regularly, and we were already going, and I had a list of names I wanted to contact on the record, and I realized that a lot of them were in Nashville, and we were going there the next week. Like, we had recorded the rhythm tracks. And so I started making phone calls, and Pettigo started calling people about borrowing gear. And the label let me get an Airbnb that was larger than we needed. So it had extra bedrooms so we could pull the mattresses out and make a studio in the living room. And so, yeah, I think for a couple $100, we had a studio set up at an Airbnb, and we just stocked the fridge with beer and food and had people come over. And a lot of them hadn't heard the tracks before, so it was all like, you know, in the moment.
Adding their flavor.
Just make something up.
That kind of stuff. Cool.
And just started tracking stuff. We did that for about a day and a half and got dobro, banjo, some harmonies from Mallory Eagle and pedal steel. We got quite a few different guitar tones laid down. So I'd say 80% of the lead work on the record was all done in that makeshift studio.
Oh wow, that's so cool. What's it like? I've actually never been as an adult. So I spent like most of my childhood in Kentucky, and then I moved to Texas. We moved to San Antonio when I was 13. So spent some time in Tennessee when we were living there, but I've never been to Nashville as an adult, or as like somebody who loves music now and am like, oh wow, Nashville is really cool. What's it like compared to the music scene here in North Texas?
Well, at least for country and Americana music, Nashville is, I mean, it's the hub. Like, you can, even if pop country isn't your thing or whatever, you can't deny that Nashville is where most of the music business is happening for these genres. And, you know, Music Row is Music Row. Like, you go down the strip and there's Universal and there's RCA and there's Sony and BMI and ASCAP. I mean, like, every major company that's a player in the game has an office in Nashville. So, you know, that means their employees are also there, and you're running into those people at bars, and you're running into those people at song swaps or whatever. So there are just so – it's such a small town. I think the population is even less than Austin. Like, I think it's around half a million or something.
Oh, okay.
I
realize
that. And the amount of industry people that are there is just so dense that the networking is – crazy. It's hard to go to a bar and not run into someone that's influential in some way in the music industry. So for networking and for just hanging out and meeting people, it's really awesome. But as far as like live shows there, you know, a lot of the scene is on the Broadway on the strip, where people are doing covers and that sort of thing. And that's kind of, you got to pay your dues and work your way up there to get a shot to do kind of a Nashville country thing. Mm-hmm. But in East Nashville, that's more the indie side of the river. And that's, you see more traditional country and Americana. That's the side that I usually hang out on. And the level of musicianship there is just insane. So Dallas is, as far as music scenes go in cities, Dallas has an incredible scene. We have great players and writers and producers and players. And I mean, it's just, it's a really great scene.
Would you ever consider moving to Nashville, or would you always want to have Dallas as like a home base?
I definitely want to stay here. I've like, when I first started making the trips to Nashville regularly, a lot of people were asking me if I was going to move, and I kind of thought about it for a second. I didn't even really think about it. I just looked into like what rent would cost out there and stuff like that. And
with that much, just wanted to see the price comparison.
Yeah. And I just quickly realized that it was easier to pop in and get stuff done in a three or four day trip than it was if you lived there. Once you live there, it becomes hard to like schedule stuff, I feel like.
Got it. Because
there's like a kind of a sense of urgency. Like, if I call everyone I know and I'm like, I'm gonna be there for 4 days, then we make sure to get something on the books. Where if we all live in the same town and we're seeing each other at the same bars all the time, I feel like I'd be at kind of a disadvantage. So
I
felt like it was almost better to be a visitor. So no, I don't plan on moving. Plus, I really love East Dallas, and I love the community that we're growing here. And, you know, being part of State Fair Records, and we're trying to grow something there as well. And I get to be a part of that while I'm in town. And,
absolutely. Just, what else are you doing for the State Fair label?
Whatever they need me to, Courtney Wright Wells, she's kind of the label manager. And her and I work together to accomplish whatever it is we need to accomplish. And we put a great, like, Trey Johnson and Scott, they've put a great staff together, and the company is growing all the time. I think we have, between owners and Courtney and I and staff, are up to like seven or something people that are working. So yeah, it's just growing all the time. There's always stuff to do, making sure things get done on time, making sure things are being promoted correctly, and distribution. I mean, so basically just any operations stuff that needs to be handled, and they're out of manpower, they'll maybe ask me to do it. Or I get to do a lot of creative stuff there, like planning and some design stuff, you know, just
oh, that's cool.
Whatever, really.
another creative outlet for you to an extent?
Yeah. I'm super hands-on with my own records. Like I come up with the visual art for the record and, you know, I arrange the, I don't know. I'm a little bit of a control freak. Yeah. So like I always have something to say about every little part of the record, but because of that, you know, like I've learned stuff over the years. And so if there's something that needs to be done, or planned or whatever, I usually have a little bit of experience in it from just doing it for myself. So
that's right. And then it always just kind of, they just feed each other, your own music and the State Fair. You can kind of go back and forth and you learn stuff from both sides, I guess I would imagine, right?
For sure. And in with any, you know, label that's starting, I mean, it's not a startup. We've been around for 6 or more years now. Mm-hmm. You know, there are like 30 directions that anything can go in all the time. And mm-hmm. each one is being moved forward incrementally. So it's kind of like there are just a ton of hats to be worn at a label. And there's 6 or 7 of us that are always trading hats and, you know, okay, you work on this, you do that, you know, and our strengths. So we kind of just get shuffled around doing different stuff all the time.
Set break. We'll be back after these messages.
The Other Ones Foundation is a nonprofit that offers extremely low barrier employment, case management, and humanitarian aid to people experiencing homelessness. The Other Ones Foundation pays people experiencing homelessness a dignified wage of $15 an hour to work in service of their community, cleaning parks, running free public shower trailers around town, learning general contractor work, and more. Donate, learn more, and get involved at toofound.org. That's TOOFound.org. The Other Ones Foundation, transitioning Austin's homeless neighbors into an engaged community through shelter, opportunity, and support.
So you're doing some songwriting kind of for some other artists you mentioned. Is writing, you know, just lyrics or words, poetry, is that just something that just kind of flows through you that you do in your spare time or something that you've been doing more of since coronavirus and lockdown, quarantine, all that?
I'm always writing something. I have probably 60 unfinished songs in my phone right now. So like, I'll think of a line and I write the line down and then I'll forget about it. And then 2 weeks later, I'll think of another line and go, oh, that goes with that line. And I'll go add it to the note. And maybe, you know, I'll sit down a month from now and go through my notes and that'll stand out and I'll start working on that song and it'll get halfway done. So there's always like a ton of songs in progress that are, you know, being worked on. Doing a songwriting session is kind of a different thing. You go in with your writing team and you sit down and in 3 hours you have a finished song.
Oh, wow. The lyrics, everything.
Yeah. Like you, at the end of the session, you turn on your phone, you know, voice memo thing and you record the song and that's it. And you submit it. And it's kind of a totally different exercise than writing on your own. And I'd never done it until John Pettigo took me back in like 2018 sometime. And I was super nervous and then we did it and I was like, oh, that was really fun. And now I try to get together with people and write as much as I can. And when I say I write for other people, I mean, you know, the idea is that someone will cut the song one day and you just, you write as much as you can. And so I write songs that I maybe wouldn't necessarily record myself. They're not in my style or they're not, the content isn't something that I would put on a record or whatever, but it's still a good song. So it just kind of lives out there in the ether. And then because we're writing with people who have publishing deals, the songs that they write get pitched to the artists. So the idea is that you collaborate with them and then your song just becomes part of a queue and maybe someone hears it, maybe someone cuts it one day.
You know, has coronavirus and lockdown, you know, everybody has been kind of dealing with this, like mental health, like the, you know, fall of the music industry this year, you know, all of these things. Has it gotten to you at all?
I mean, everything at some point. I've had a lot of time to think. Say the first 2 or 3 weeks, I panicked.
Yeah.
I was angry. I drank too much. and
there's nothing else to do, you know?
Right. I quickly realized that there was, there, you know, this was going to last a long time and I had to continue to be productive. So, after drinking a lot for 2 weeks, yeah, I started trying to figure out, you know, what we could do. And I probably spent a month coming up with all these crazy ways to have a show and none of them came to fruition because as soon as we put a plan together, the rules would change. And, right, you know, so I lost about a month to that. Yeah. And then, finally gave up on trying to put together live shows because the logistics were just too difficult and too unpredictable. Mm-hmm. And started focusing on doing session work and writing and recording new material. So Ottoman Turks, we finished up our second record during COVID. And my producer, he's been writing a new record. And so I've helped him finish up some singles.
Oh, cool.
I've been playing guitar on a couple people's records. And then I wrote my whole third record. We're probably going to record that in the next month or so.
Wow. Just cranking them out, man.
Yeah.
Do you have a title for that one?
I do. It's see you next time.
Yeah. I was like, it has to be something kind of around the same kind of theme. What do you know whenever, I mean, are you just, are you guys going to sit on that and then probably release that next year or what's the, do you have a time frame?
Yeah, it probably won't be out until next summer.
Cool.
It takes about a year. From the time you start cutting the record to the time it's out is usually about 12 months.
Okay. Okay. Very, very cool. What's the kind of the favorite song that you, you know, for whatever reason on this latest album on Glad You Made It? And I guess as far as this new third record goes, have you guys already kind of parsed through or is this part of like the 60 songs kind of you have that y'all are gonna put together?
I have probably 15 songs that I want to bring in. That's kind of what I've done, taking in 12 to 15 songs. Uh-huh. We cut the rhythm tracks and then we decide which ones are keepers and then move on to you know, overdubbing and doing lead stuff and building the track out that way. But the song I'm most excited about on, were you asking about Glad You Made It, the album that just came out? Or are you saying, yeah, what am I excited about the new one? I don't know. I mean, Voices, I'm really proud about with how Voices came out. And
it's
that's
really
a, you know, really
song. Love it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. It's a really personal one. But I think for me, like just as a, like watching my writing progress, a song that I'm proud of is a Boat Show Girl.
Yeah.
Beautiful. I think that, I don't know, sometimes you write a song and it, you finish it and you look back, you're like, oh wow, I did that. They're like, that's cool.
That came out of me. I didn't know that was in there.
Yeah. Like Lot Lizard was that song from the first record. And so like Canyon was like the big personal ballad that everyone kind of got behind, but I actually was most proud of Lot Lizard. And mm-hmm. then on this record, Voices is kind of the Canyon of this record. And, but I'm actually most proud of Boat Show Girl.
Yeah. You have a really beautiful way of writing. It's like simple. It just reminds me of like, you know, that classic country, you know, telling stories in like a simple, but beautiful, beautiful way. Have you always been into writing or Texas country, or is that what you were raised on, or kind of where did that, your kind of affinity for writing come into play?
It just kind of happened. Like when I was growing up, I listened to a lot of bluegrass.
Okay.
Like when I was really little and I started playing guitar and banjo when I was like six.
Wow.
And then got into flamenco and world music. And I've always liked jazz. And then I got into punk and metal in junior high and played in rock bands all through junior high and high school. And I grew up with 90s country, of course, you know, like it Brooks was always on in the house or, Brooks and Dunn, Keith Whitley, Tracy Lawrence. And so I guess at some point I decided that country was like for old people, you know, those for my parents or my grandparents.
Yeah.
And I was, so I wanted to play rock music. I was angsty and I wanted to play something that sounded angry. So, and then my, my drummer, this guy, Will Martin, I grew up with him. He was in the first band I was ever in. He was like, just listen to it. He was listening to, The Range, the country station, The Range here in Dallas. It was his senior year of high school. And he was like, just try it out. And I had been so, and I realized up until that point, I don't think I actually knew the lyrics to any song all the way through. Like I never really paid attention to lyrics. I was always listening to the arrangement or what the drummer was playing or the guitar riffs or whatever. It just didn't really interest me
to listen to lyrics. They just didn't catch my attention. And then my friend that kind of had the same feeling about music as I did, he got into country again, predominantly Texas country, and was like, just check it out. So I listened, we turned on the radio and a Hayes Carl song came on and something clicked. I was just like, oh, I get it. Like my, you know, all this sad country music, a lot of it is pretty like tongue in cheek. You know, it's very self-aware music, or it can be. And so I loved that Hayes Carl song.
Nature of it.
Yeah. And then Dublin Blues by Guy Clark came on next, which is now one of my favorite songs ever. And I was like, okay, there's something here. And we listened to four or five songs in a row and they were all amazing. And it just kind of set me off on a new path of listening to singer-songwriters and, you know, more Texas country. And then I guess about a year later, 2 years later, I wrote a song and it came out and it was country and I didn't even know it was country. I showed it to a friend and they're like, oh, cool, you're writing country music. And I was like, no. And then I thought about it. I was like, oh man, this is a country song. all of it was a country song. I just didn't realize it. And then I just kept writing. They just kept coming out after that. And I actually played that song in high.
Oh, the first one you ever wrote. I remember that.
It's called Fondly. It's on the first record.
Yeah.
And something clicked. Like that song all poured out in one night in like 20 minutes. And I was like, oh, it's actually, you know, pretty good. Maybe I should try to write another one. And then the second song I wrote was Pale Hands, which also ended up on the first record.
Right.
And it just kind of happened that way. And I kept writing. I haven't had to trash many songs since then. And I just write really slow. So it took 10 years. Also, you know, I had to find the funding to make the record.
Is that kind of how you got hooked up with State Fair Records at that point? Or were you already working with them?
I had recorded an EP in 2016 and put it out. And I was playing more solo shows. I think I was playing 200, 250 solo shows a year. Okay. And I was trying to self-release EPs. You know, it's expensive to put music out. So I would save up some money, record a couple songs, And I had met John Pettigo through the Ottoman Turks. We played a few shows with the O's. Pettigo is in a band called the O's. And I knew he was producing a few people and he told me if I ever wanted to record to hit him up. So I did. And we started working on an EP. It was going to be all acoustic. It had Pale Hands, Fondly, Working Girl and Canyon on it. Mm-hmm. No, Working Girl and something else. And in the process of recording that EP, I wrote Canyon.
Oh,
and
cool.
The next time I went into the studio, he asked why I wasn't making a full record. And I told him it's because I don't have any money. And he was like, well, if you were to write a full record, what would you, you know, you'd need more songs. What else would you put on it? Yeah. I think I showed him Lot Lizard and Canyon because I just written those. Uh-huh. And he thought they were really good. And so he recorded some quick demos of those songs, and he went and showed Canyon to State Fair Records, Trey Johnson, one of the owners over there. Mm-hmm. And Trey liked it, and he came out like the next week to see me play one of my residencies that I had. Mm-hmm. In Dallas, and we met and he liked it, and then like 2 months later I was in the studio making Wish You Were Here.
Wow, that's so cool. So that was 2018, around when you started that process of making the album?
That would have been, yeah, because we started recording in February of 18, and then it came out January of 19.
Okay.
So I guess he came to see me in late 2017.
Okay. Did you ever have like a vocal coach, or were you just blessed with just a beautiful voice? I mean, your range is amazing. So I'm like, do you have singing lessons, or are you just born this way?
No, I grew up singing in choir, like in, I went to a little private, Christian school, and, I became friends with the choir director's kids. Actually, Billy Law, he's in Billy Law. He's also the bassist for Ottoman Turks. I've known him since I was 6 and he was 4.
No way.
I was in first grade with his sister. And their mom was our choir director at the school.
Oh.
So, yeah, so they asked me to go to their church, and then she was a choir director there too. So at least a few times a week I was singing in choir. And I think I got like 2 vocal lessons from her. Mm-hmm. In high school, because I was going to try out for Booker T, the arts magnet here in town.
Yeah.
But other than that, no, I've never had any of like real vocal training. I don't sing correctly. Luckily, I'd say the one thing I actually picked up from back then was I learned how to breathe when I sing, and I sing, you know, from the diaphragm or whatever. But there's so much I don't know about singing. Just my friends who've had some success in their careers, they start taking vocal lessons just to preserve their voice. And I've learned quite a few tips from them, but I was actually about to start a vocal coach like right before COVID hit. But I haven't done it because I haven't been out singing.
Right.
but no real training.
Did you end up going to Booker T?
Nope. I didn't make the cut.
Wow. I'm also curious. That place just cranks them out. But yeah, I'm always like, it's just so funny. Dallas just has just such an immense amount of talent here. Texas in general. But what is it that makes Texas music, Texas music?
Like, one thing growing up here is you're exposed to a lot of diversity that you're not aware of. It's part of the culture. So it just feels normal, to know Volver or whatever, you know, like people, you just know, you have all this, you know, kind of media coming at you just from growing up here that other communities aren't exposed to. So I think that has something to do with it. Of course, like, you know, the blues is here because of the strong Black community we had in Dallas. And so blues music is rooted here. And so you grow up on that, and, you know, everybody knows a Stevie Ray Vaughan song because he learned from, you know, hearing real blues records, and then it just became part of the ethos here. And then you have classic country, you have cowboy music, you have Tejano, you have you know, all these things that are mixing together. You have a strong German background that influenced polka music, and then polka music ended up influencing Mexican music, and that's why Northern Mexican music has tuba and accordion in it. And it all just, you know, it's not like a modern thing. I mean, all this music, Appalachian music from Irish immigrants came here, and I mean, it's just this big melting pot of music.
World music, yeah.
Basically. Yeah, and so I feel like you get a little bit of that flavor and everything here. There's no kind of milquetoast music. Everything has a kind of quirky personality to it. And then we're just raised to have this sort of pride and independence being from Texas, that I feel like there's a lot of
class.
A lot of attitude and confidence in the music, and because of cowboy music, there's just storytelling is really important here. And I feel like sincerity is a pretty common thread in Texas music as well. So I guess it's just a lot of stuff, but the culture, just Texas makes Texas music, Texas music.
Yeah, exactly. Is there anything else that you're excited about for the rest of 2020 that you want to share with our awesome listeners on this podcast episode?
Sure. I was able to launch a plus size clothing company during COVID called High, Wide, and Handsome.
Oh, cool. Okay. So,
awesome. That's something I've had the idea for years and didn't have the time to get it started. And we launched back in May, I think, maybe April. I partnered with Travel by Gravel on that. And so right now it's t-shirt designs, but eventually I'll be expanding to other clothing. But it's a
just size awesome inclusive blazer that you have on your album cover, which is so cool, by the way. That's kind of cool. What's the what kind of stuff would you, is it going to be that kind of stuff or more casual stuff like t-shirts, that type of thing?
I'm probably going to do, I mean, eventually I'd like to do a line of tropical shirts, because that's something I wear all the time.
Me too. I like this.
And so anything really, as long as it's size inclusive, it will probably be casual at first, just because that's easier to manufacture, you know, when you're getting started. Everything will have a little Western or Texas kind of flair to it. Really, it's just about being size inclusive. Like, I have a lot of people come up to me at shows and ask where I get my clothes and stuff. And it's just hard to find quality clothing that is stylish in my size. It takes a lot of research and time that a lot of people just don't want to invest. Because it's not like, just it's
fun, because like clothes should be representative of your personality a little bit, right? Not just in you end up being like, I hate going shopping because it's such a pain in the ass every single time, right? You're like
You know, I feel like a lot of clothing brands that make clothing for plus size people tend to make everything as neutral and generic as possible, because they feel like people my size want to blend in. But I feel like a lot of times when you try to blend in and you're wearing really generic stuff, you kind of just poke out even more, especially if you're not comfortable or you don't feel cool or
confident
sexy in what you're wearing. Like, it's just like, you know, it's worse to wear a big forest green t-shirt and some khaki cargo shorts or whatever, because that's the only thing you can find in your size. You know, just little things like
You're kind of changing the idea too, where it's like, hey, it's okay to stand out and it's okay to like personality, you know, which is completely changing the ideology, I feel like, too, you know.
And I've always had a pretty flamboyant sense of style. And so it's frustrating that you can't find anything like that. Like that jacket on my cover, me and my girlfriend had to make that.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And, you know, just because there isn't anything in that size. So, you know, I just want to make stuff like that more readily available to people. And it's everything. Like, eventually I'll be giving tips on how to find products I can't make, like cowboy boots and hats and stuff like that. Because I wear a size 14 wide boot. So you can't just go into a vintage shop and buy some cool boots because you can't find that size boot. Or like I wear a size 7 3/4 Stetson. That's the largest size Stetson they make. So you can't find it in every hat shop. I wear a size 15 ring. So like it's not just a shirt size. It's like a whole
aesthetic.
I'm excited about that. I'll be expanding that probably in the fall, and
cool.
Lots of stuff. I mean, this is
pop-ups,
giving a lot of time to start bands.
That's cool. So are you equally as much of a control freak on this project as your other projects?
Yeah, I'm kind of a control freak about everything. I think too much, probably. I love the details. I love planning. That's just kind of how my brain works. Mm-hmm. And I like seeing how everything fits together. And so I tend to micromanage a little bit.
And that is a wrap for this week's episode. Thank you to Joshua Ray Walker for taking the time to speak with me on Zoom. You can check out his music on all streaming platforms, and you can buy his latest album, Glad You Made It, on vinyl, probably from your local record store. If you've been enjoying our podcast, please subscribe, review. If you have iTunes, share it with your friends. And thanks so much for listening. We will see y'all next week.
You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. You can subscribe to Lone Sound Magazine at lonesoundmagazine.com.